You're listening to Practically Ideal.
You gotta be practically ideal instead of just ideal.
Ready for some podcasting.
Oh, Logan, you got any better, man?
All work and no play.
And we are live. This is Practically Culture, a podcast devoted to TV, movies, and other pop culture. I'm your host, Logan Doe, podcasting from Brooklyn, New York. I'm joined tonight by the one, the only, Bob Caswell in the Bay Area. How are you, Bob?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Oh, you know me. Just hanging out.
Nice.
Welcome to the new and improved podcast. We've got Pacific Rim, a ton of mini reviews, and three TV recaps. Ray Donovan, The Newsroom, and The Bridge. It's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. Let's rock. Oh man, it's good to be back. You look great, by the way, Bob, as we video cast this live as Google Plus Hangout on air.
Thank you. You're not too shabby looking yourself.
Thank you for noticing. ready to get to it?
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay, Pacific Rim. As a war between humankind and monstrous sea creatures wages on, a former pilot and a trainee are paired up to drive a seemingly obsolete special weapon in a desperate effort to save the world from the apocalypse. It stars Charlie Hunnam, most famously of Sons of Anarchy, and Idris Elba, most famously from The Wire, directed by Guillermo del Toro, who I think of as the guy behind Pan's Labyrinth, but who also did the superhero movies Hellboy and Hellboy 2.
Ah.
The first thing I noticed, Bob, is no really big blockbuster-style movie stars in this movie.
No, you had to remind me of where I should remember these actors from, because I haven't seen all of those other productions that you mentioned. So unless you're like a big TV fan, which we try to be or we tend to be, yeah, these aren't movie stars by the traditional definition, which is probably a good thing. I don't think the movie was about them as much as it was about other things, and it worked well in that way.
And I want to say it was also very well cast for these not being, you know, big-time movie stars. I like Idris Elba as, what's his name, Stryker? you know, the guy who had been a pilot but then graduated to be the head of the Jaeger force. And, you know, we got to learn some background. He also could be a hard-ass but a softy. I thought he was well cast. And Charlie Hunnam, this is like the thing he's best at in the entire world. Like if you watch Sons of Anarchy, he's like this young guy, tons of talent and energy and masculinity, and he needs to learn to keep it together better. He's like on the verge of spiraling out of control always, but it's that riding the line that makes him so compelling, and that's like exactly what was needed for this role.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was pretty well cast, even though they're not big stars.
Yeah, and you make it sound like what he was trying to accomplish by writing that line is like a really complicated and nuanced character, which it could have been, but it also could just be stereotypical and like, you know, the bad boy who is good, but it pushes the envelope too far. I don't know. In the movie, it was somewhere in the middle for me, but maybe we should do our mini reviews, set the tone here a little bit, see what we each think of this, right?
Okay, sounds good. Do it.
All right, so here's what I gave it. Pacific Rim, 3.5 out of 5. Robots and monsters, oh my. Enjoyable enough as a well-paced guilty pleasure of what were the best parts of sci-fi when I was like 12. Nowadays, though, I want a bit more out of my characters and story.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to have to sheepishly admit that I don't have my mini review typed out, but I'll give you the highlights. Also, a mini review on the fly.
Let's do it.
One thing I've already hinted at, non-A-list movie stars, but still really well cast. Almost too much story, but that's a refreshing change. And very characteristically, Guillermo del Toro. 3.5 stars.
Wow.
Wait. Did I say 3.5? That's what you said. Four.
Yeah. Four. That's what I heard the first time, and
four
I was like,
stars.
Did my ears deceive me? Logan is giving an action summer blockbuster movie a higher rating than me? I don't know what that means, but it feels significant.
Yeah, well, of all the ones I've seen, I think it's the one that I'd recommend as most. I guess, I mean, Star Trek, I think I gave four or four so stars. Yeah, anyways, let's get back to it. Those are our mini reviews. And what did you think about the story? You wanted more from this story. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I'm surprised that you almost had too much of it. I felt like I liked the premise, and the way it starts out, by the way, is they have kind of a narrator for the first 5 or 10 minutes, which is kind of just like boom, 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 sets it up very directly. Here's the premise. Here's these giant monsters. We had to adjust as a society and create giant robots to fight these giant monsters that come out of the Earth.
Yeah, didn't you feel like that almost could have been its own movie? Like, we don't know what's happening. We scramble to try to defeat a few of them while we're trying to put together this program, and then we finally start kicking their asses. That could have been like a whole movie, right?
Right, it could have been. But this movie was more about the, you know, fast forward, and this has been happening for a long time, and we're now losing, and we're more like a resistance, and how do we stop the world from coming to an end, which is a decent premise on its own, but I felt like the premise that was rushed through maybe was a little bit more interesting. And the other point of the story that was rushed through, which I wanted more from, was the political scene. So we have politicians come into play midway through the movie, and there's a couple of options like, hey, we can build giant robots and make more, or last resort, put them all together and keep going and doing this, or we're going to build a giant wall. And then you see like a screen of politicians debating, and it seemed like reminiscent of today, different solutions for a complicated problem, but this one was a pretty massive problem for the whole world. But then it's quickly dismissed, and the movie becomes more about just the military dudes in control, and there's no connection to Washington anymore, or, you know, global UN headquarters or whatever it is. And so that was disappointing for me.
You're right, that was rushed through. In fact, I practically even forgot about that whole thing until you mentioned it, because it was such a minor afterthought.
Yeah. So why was it so much? Why was there tons of story for you? And maybe that's not necessarily a good thing, I'm assuming it is.
Like I say, I felt like that first part could have been its own movie. I felt like it was almost like a trilogy smashed into one movie. Mm. And we got Raleigh, played by Charlie Hunnam. It was practically like the whole hero's journey, but just a sketch of it. If that had been more of the story, I might have thought it would be more effective and let it breathe more, because he starts off being really promising. He has this huge defeat that makes him question himself and go into hiding, and then they come back and find him. No, you're our last hope. Because everyone else is dead, and then he comes back, and it turns out that even though he's a little bit outdated, and then the Jaeger he drives is antiquated, it turns out that being old is a reason that he can triumph in the end.
Right.
These are spoiler free, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that could have been a whole movie arc in its own. But that doesn't describe the whole movie, if I just say that, you know, right? And I think also Stryker's his whole story could have been a story about a guy who it's hard to say that without so many spoilers, but he had some success, then he had to change career paths, and he made it to be the leader, and then at the end he finds a measure of redemption on his own where he thought that he might not find any. That could have been, if that had been allowed to breathe and been more fleshed out, that could have been an interesting story too. I just felt like there were all these storylets, but we didn't focus on any one of them quite well enough.
No, so I think we are agreeing here. I think we're saying the same thing, because I wanted more from the cohesive story, like society at large, and what we got were like three, because there's also the Japanese girl, she has her own story, and she also gets like a pretty sophisticated flashback scene, which takes a lot of time, and
yeah,
is kind of cool from a special effects perspective, but it's just like one more character expose, or whatever you want to call it, and you know, it's ironic, because what I wanted more from was characters in the story, according to my mini review, but everything I got from these individualized stories was kind of a half-assed approach, or just not satisfying enough, and it really wasn't about a cohesive story or a really interesting character arc or character-driven drama. It was just like, oh, we got to show you the token flashback for our lead actors in the show, and then they all come together and save the world for different reasons or whatever, and that felt a little too Hollywood-y, maybe. but I guess what do we do, you know?
Yeah, well, that's fair. And I mean, I just liked it that I saw the outlines of a story that I recognize, and I feel like in so many movies lately I haven't, even though you're right, it's half-assed. For example, one of the scenes that I remember was when Raleigh, this, you know, our young Charlie, or not so young Charlie Hunnam pilot, he's going to figure out if he's going to be paired with the girl Mako, and they have this this fight. It's like this choreographed thing, and then she's, you know, Chinesey with the bow, and he's pretty good, but he just doesn't look as smooth. He looks like this American choppy, even though he's English, this Western choppy guy who's good but not quite as smooth. And then at the end, they're like, "Did you feel it? Did you feel it? We were obviously meant to be together." And I'm like, "What? I didn't feel it watching. What are you talking about?"
Right. Well, and the movie does play, you know, fast and loose with some of these, with some of its premise of, like, you know, connecting brains and memories being shared by this new technology that just so happened to be invented just in time to be the pivotal point of how to control giant robots in a way that makes sense to take on giant monsters. And now we're like, you know, the movie's based in like 2020 or something, and it has like some Star Trek-esque technology that normally you don't give the Star Trek pass unless you're a Star Trek movie and it's 1,000 years later, but like 5 years later, and now we can meld minds together. I don't know.
I gave it a pass on that one, but you're right. Oh, my dog wants to make his first appearance on the cast here. Oh, you little silly dog. So the other thing I wanted to talk about was the Guillermo del Toro imprint on this.
Yes.
Like I said, I think of him mostly as Pan's Labyrinth, which is a very different kind of movie. But he's also done Hellboy and Hellboy 2, which weren't huge budget necessarily, but they were sort of in this vein of action movies that are ambitious with visual effects and with archetypal storylines. Are you a big Guillermo del Toro fan?
I mean, I've seen both Hellboy movies, and I like them fine enough, kind of in the same category as this. I don't think I gave them ratings in the same scale, but they're probably 3.5 out of 5 movies, and Pan's Labyrinth actually is a step above. I like that movie quite a bit. So, long story short, yeah, I consider myself fan enough, I guess.
And I could see very much the visual style of Guillermo del Toro. My favorite part that I just went back and it just put a smile on my face and I thought, yeah, that's Guillermo, was when Charlie Day's character is looking for Hannibal Chow, played by Ron Perlman, and he finds him in just this room that's like all the different kinds of red you can imagine, and his outfit is like the best. Has like this crushed velvet pattern with like this red leather vest and the striped red shirt and this paisley red tie.
Yeah.
And just these gold shoes and these glasses. I don't know. Just so red,
yeah,
and so stylized. I just love that.
Yeah, Del Toro does like set design matched with costume design. Like, he really takes the whole scene and makes it its own. Like, he did that in Hellboy a lot too. There's just lots of intricate detail, and it's very deliberate how the character's outfit and style kind of matches the atmospheric setup as well. And there's intricacies all over if you're looking for him. I felt in this movie he might have been stifled a little bit almost, because when he does these giant scenes, and I guess we'll get to this with the special effects, you see his kind of stamp of approval or footprint on it, but then you see like a lot of other stuff that makes you feel like, oh, this is just any old, you know, giant robot special effects. I don't know if that makes sense, but there's like there's this weird contrast of like this artsy, unique spin on being creative in the way you put together these set designs, and then there's the, you know, just what you'd imagine giant Legos looking like, and he had to sort of mash those together somehow.
Yeah, when I think of Guillermo del Toro, and because he designs his monsters and aliens really distinctively with all these exaggerated features and long drawn-out lines and intricate designs and things like that, and I was looking for that, and I kind of sort of thought I saw some of that sometimes in the robots and in the monsters, but not as much as I was hoping for, so I agree with that.
Right, and it was mostly the robots. I think he had a little more of a free pass, or maybe it's just the by definition monsters you can do a little bit more with. But I feel like this is going to be like a nerd alert moment, but the movie's premise suffered from the fact that it had giant robots, and that was fundamentally part of the story. And there were so many scenes where I just felt like, why are they giant robots? Is this really the best humanity can do? Why is fighting monsters solved by giant robots, other than it would make for a good sci-fi movie? And there's just a lot of funny scenes that aren't intentionally funny, where it's like, fire your rockets. Oh no, I don't think that'll work. Okay, well, use your giant sword. And it's like the giant sword that comes off of the giant robot arm you're controlling. And it's like, what? This doesn't make any sense at all in terms of.
And that was like the best weapon of the whole thing. Once they started using that, they were really kicking ass.
Yeah, there were so many scenes. Like another example that drove me crazy, because it was obvious that it was just like a throwaway token, you know, this is a summer movie, is like one scene where they're fighting a giant alien. They like pick up, I don't know if it was a bus or, no, it was a giant freighter ship. And they like pick it up and use it like a baguette to smack the monster. Yeah. And it's like, hey, if you're going to spend, if the collective universe of, you know, humanity on this planet is going to get together and spend billions of dollars to construct giant robots, you think that what they put in the fists would be a little bit better for hurting an alien than picking up a ship as a baguette? But, you know, that's just those little things that maybe only I care to point out.
For some reason, I let myself get swept up in the, you know, in the reality as it presented it to me, things like that. But you're right. Obviously, if you look for things like that, you'll find plenty of them, because it is that kind of movie.
Right.
So, yeah, I think, so overall, it's a thumbs up for us.
Yeah, I think it's an enjoyable, it's escapism for me. I called it a guilty pleasure because I didn't think the acting wasn't bad. Oh, and that's another thing. Charlie Day, who's most famous for It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, he plays a scientist, and it's just, and then he's already like a stretch, but then there's some other dude that's, I don't know where he's from, I should have looked it up, but he plays a scientist who's even quirkier. And they're just like hammy, over-the-top, like mad scientist characters in the sci-fi movie. Like, they don't even try to like make them seem plausibly, you know, normal in terms of what a scientist could be in real life. But it's part of the gimmick.
A little
part
comic relief, I guess. I don't know. I thought they were amusing. Yeah. But what you say is right.
Right. Yeah. This is definitely like a guy's night out. You know. Guilty pleasure, sci-fi extravaganza with special effects and robots fighting monsters. There's not much depth. You're not going to see anything about how humanity deals with the end of the world. That's not as much the point as the just robots bashing on aliens point. So I
thought it was appropriately stirring, though, in the speeches around, oh, let's do this, or whatever he says.
Right, let's talk, or... The military-driven, you know, this is our last stand, humanity's relying on us, and that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was fine. It was good. I just wanted more scale and scope, because I kept realizing that it's just this small resistance force, but you didn't get to see, like, all the other countries or politicians figuring out the end of the world together. But in the context that it was, sure, it presented it pretty fairly.
All right, so 4 stars from me, 3.5 from you, Bob. There you go, Pacific Rim.
Check it out.
All right, let's get to some mini reviews, Bob. What do you have for us?
Okay, this week I just have one. I only saw one other movie other than Pacific Rim, so here we go. Coffee Town. I gave Coffee Town a 3.5 out of 5. This is what I said. I love the almost Seinfeld-esque conversations about nothing embedded throughout this light-hearted comedy, but I didn't love the token potty humor, and I wanted more of the parts I did enjoy, like Josh Groban's character. So this is an interesting movie for a few different reasons. For one, it's produced and it was put together by College Humor, a website that does, you know, little comedy shorts, and now they made a full-on movie with legitimate actors, and it wasn't released in theaters. It was kind of a straight to on demand, but it holds its own. It's a decent little comedy, and I'm hesitant on recommending it beyond a 3.5 out of 5, simply because the potty humor gets to be a little too much in certain scenes. It's almost it's disappointing because it's too bad, because there are a lot of funny comic relief scenes where it's just a couple of dudes sitting in a coffee shop talking about life, the universe, and everything, like Seinfeld style. And the general premise is a guy who, it's very relatable for a certain demographic, I guess, a guy who works out of a coffee shop because he can do like remote IT tech support, and so he doesn't really need his own office, or and he doesn't like working from home. He likes the atmosphere of a coffee shop, but he wants to ask out a girl that comes in and orders the same thing every day, but he can never muster up the courage. His friends stop by, and they try to help him out and picking up on this woman. It's a pretty basic premise, but it's just dudes like shooting the shit, having a good time. And I really resonate with the characters when they're not in their potty humor modes. And then Josh Groban comes into the scene. He plays the barista. And Josh Groban's a good actor. Like, he does a great job as, like, you know, a quirky caricature of a barista that is bound by his job to help you, but at the same time despises you. I think he plays the character really well. And he's got a band on the side, which is funny because it's Josh Groban, but he can't really make it big. And they show some of that. And it, having him in this fake band is and kind of ruining a night out. Some good material here. Overall, I liked it. Enjoyable. Just watch out for the potty humor, but have a good time if you're looking for a lighthearted comedy.
Josh Groban has shown up a couple times just to put my just to mention. Yeah, like, sure. He's on the last season of The Office a little bit as Dwight's was it Dwight's brother? Andy's brother, right?
I think it was Andy's brother. Yeah.
And then also in like Crazy Stupid Love, he just shows up sometimes, and he's actually a decent actor. I concur. All right.
Cool.
I've got a mini review, Bob, and that is the second season of The Killing.
Oh, I'm ready.
Less infuriating, but still overall a step down from season one, but partially saved by the great acting and a richly portrayed world. At least there was a payoff at the end this time, 3 out of 5. So the thing about The Killing, Bob, is that it does a lot of things really well. I love the two main characters and the strong sense of place right there in Seattle. It reminds me of Dexter, sort of in that way. I know you don't watch Dexter, but there are a lot of reasons I could be tired of Dexter. But I just like drop it into that world and those characters and saying hi. And The Killing's kind of like that.
Cool.
The problem is that it feels like it's stalling constantly. It's been stalling for 2 seasons now, just without any good idea of where to take this wonderful characters and what to do with this wonderful world that it's created. You know, we're still in the same case as season one, you know, the one where it's looking like it was all wrapped up, and then the bizarre last few minutes of the first season basically ruined everything. But now we're back on that case for season two. You know, it still a little bit has the problem of whiplash-inducing twists that it hasn't really laid the groundwork for, and now just the plot gets more and more implausible with the detective's behavior. And without getting too spoilery, I'll say that at a certain point in the middle, the main detective, Lyndon, played by Mira Enos, she goes so rogue that she's stripped of her authority to keep investigating by the police department. But she still manages to pull off this stuff without an actual badge. It's like, wait, there's no way that you'd be able to do that if you were told not to investigate a case. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I didn't get into The Killing when it was new, and I was going to let it go by the wayside, but when it got renewed for a third season, the hope was that some of these issues might have been addressed. You know, for one thing, in this new third season, they're onto a new case, and it's about time, I tell you. so now I'll get to that third season, which is airing now, and report on whether that's picked up. But for now, this is sort of a necessary step on the path to the third season, but we may find out that it's ultimately unnecessary to even be on this path. I will let you know.
Okay, yeah. I wonder if it was 24 that started this trend, or if it may have been earlier, but 24 had this problem. Homeland has this problem of, like, where the lead character goes rogue too much, but then somehow still can make it work and comes back and is able to save the world. It's tough because it makes for a great, like, rise in your, you know, heart rate, and you're like, oh, they're breaking the rule. But then on the other, you're like, wait a second, I've seen this, like, a lot already. And is it that plausible? It sounds like they didn't pull it off very well, and they're, like, third in line, so too bad.
yeah, I guess we'll just leave it at that if I'm not going to get too spoilery. I think that is fair enough.
Okay.
All right, well, let's get to some recaps, Bob. I want to start with The Newsroom. Season 2 of The Newsroom started on Sunday, and if you don't know The Newsroom, it's about, basically, a news anchor on cable TV who is also the most wonderful man in the world, capital letters.
Yeah.
So, the good. Aaron Sorkin is really good at the scene-by-scene business of writing a screenplay for TV, Bob. You know, there's always momentum, plenty of tension. His characters always want things, and you can tell, and just drives the action. Like, every scene is very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Sorkin show.
Yeah, almost too well done. Like, characters are, like, unbelievably witty and smart, like, at every moment of their life, which you kind of enjoy, but also this show can sometimes be exhausting. Like, I had to kind of tweak my brain a little bit and be like, oh, yeah, I'm watching The Newsroom. There's, like, twice as much dialogue per minute compared to any other show ever, and it's all, like, with fancy words and shit, you know? I gotta pay attention here.
Yeah, you know, I will say, this being the first episode, I find it kind of exhilarating to be back in there, because your first impulse is, oh, yeah, this guy respects me as an audience member. That's why he's giving it to me this fast and furious, because he knows that I'm smart enough to keep up.
Right.
But I remember that probably what'll happen is I'll get tired of it and it'll seem super gimmicky. Especially like when they, at least twice, they were like talking straight over each other and they just did it for like 5 seconds or something. And you're like, what? Who am I supposed to be listening to here?
Right. Or they'll do things like they'll talk in code where they're using the lyrics from like a 1970s The Who song. And it's like, I barely know that reference, let alone anyone else.
Yeah, no British rock, Bob. Know it.
Exactly. Which, yeah, it makes you feel special until you're like, but it's also kind of annoying. I don't know.
But before we get too much into the criticism, but I really do want to try to say some of the good things.
Okay, let's
do it. One of the real successes, again, just a great written scene, was very early on, you know, when they fact check a story and they find out there's a problem with it. We do spoilers in this one, right? So
yeah, sure.
They find that he hasn't been charged with a crime, this guy they're running the piece on, but he's just been he's under investigation. So they start trying to edit it in real time, but the show is on the air and they're about to run it and they don't know what they're going to do, and they show you the editing first and you're like, okay, maybe they get this edited in time, and then it becomes clear that they won't get it edited on time. And so then she calls up the person and wants him to do a voiceover so they can edit it, you assume, but then, no, there's no time for that. So then she cues him up perfectly, and he, over the phone, does a live voice edit, and is like, oh, yeah, that was awesome. Go get him, guys.
Yeah, that was a great scene, like everybody coming together in the control room and just making it happen, and like, yeah, that's how it's done. Woo!
yeah, and, well... So next I want to get to this point that's sort of borderline for me,
okay.
The good or the bad, and that is Will McAvoy. I can't tell. Has Will become even wittier this season, or is this just another part of his greatest man of the world routine that he's always had? Like, he just throws in these jokes at unexpected times that are super witty, these insults, wry observations. They just all come fast and furious.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time, too. I don't know if it's because it's been, like, the rest of my TV is on a lower plane or something, but he is coming through a little more pompous this season. But I kind of want to rewatch the first season to validate that, or, you know, see if that's just the way he is. So I don't know.
I will say I thought it sort of charming, you know, seeing Rebecca Black's Friday during breaks. It was dorky, but at the same time, you know, charming.
Right.
But that's the thing about Will McAvoy. I feel like that Rebecca Black thing is emblematic of the thing of Will McAvoy. So... even his flaws just make him more heroic. Like, that's supposedly dorky that he sings Friday, but it's actually charming. It's not that dorky, it's just quirky. You know, and then he calls the Tea Party the American Taliban, for instance. But what they do is they make sure to explain that he was careful not to say Al-Qaeda because the Taliban never attacked America, and if people were only smart enough to be on Will McAvoy's level, they wouldn't be so upset with this. It's their problem. It's Will's flaw is that he lives in a world that's not up to his greatness.
Yeah. Well, and there's some jokes that don't resonate with me as well, but then it works for everybody else in the room in terms on the show. And like, for example, at the beginning, he's kind of giving this lawyer who's interrogating him, presumably for stuff we haven't seen yet, or that event that you just described. And she's like, "You said this, da da da," and he's kind of giving these quirky answers and just being a pain in the ass. And then she's like, "Fuck me," and he's like, "Will somebody in the room please fuck her?" as she asks. And it just, in the moment, I was like, rolled my eyes a little bit, and it didn't seem that funny. But then she acknowledged, she's like, "Actually, that was actually kind of funny." And it was right after he tried to make another joke, and she was like, "That's not funny," and she was trying to be serious. And the show plays a lot off of that, of these like very almost too self-aware characters that are just like,
yeah,
like, you know, battling it out on a as part of a stage play or something, where they're using words to see who wins which scene or something.
Well, you talk about being self-aware when Maggie goes up to Jim and she's like, "This is awkward, right?" And he's like, "No. Well, I just thought that if we said it was awkward, then it wouldn't be awkward anymore." That's just exactly what we're talking about, being hyper self-aware.
Yeah, it's like, okay, the meta conversation, you can dial it down. Why don't you guys like interact with each other like humans instead of like, you know, English majors or something? I don't know.
Okay. All right. I also want to talk about Occupy Wall Street. It got a little bit soapboxy, and this actually dinged one of my three major problem areas with Newsroom from last season. And this one was a full on, you know, danger Will Robinson. It started out fine with Neil learning that OccupyWallStreet.com had been registered. Yeah. And Mackenzie was skeptical, saying, "Let's wait till there's an actual story here," which I thought was refreshing. Someone was an actual grown-up like they would be in a newsroom.
Right.
But she says, "Keep an eye on it." And he goes to the meeting, and his efforts culminate in a scene with the not-in-charge chick who's in charge.
Yes.
And here's when my 2020 hindsight alarm starts going off. So Neil starts grilling her. He's like, "Shouldn't you stick to one clear goal? And won't the horizontal structure let people grab power who shouldn't have it?" And it's like, oh, well, what do you know? A point that listened to Neil, a minor producer at a cable news show. The main problem with Occupy Wall Street could have been addressed early on, and it would have gone so much better for the whole movement.
And she almost had this, like, "I am Gandhi." Like, she was, like, so on top of having the right answer for everything, as if Occupy Wall Street is like manna from heaven, and it's only here under our noses, the solution to all the problems in American politics. It's just so clearly laid out for us. And I'll be honest, I didn't follow Occupy Wall Street that closely. I thought it was kind of interesting, some things, but the way the show wants you to remember it is like, these are brilliant people who are doing a brilliant thing. I don't know where they're going to go with it. It's just in this one episode, they sort of set it up as like, this is the smart way to impact government, and if you're smart, and she's a PhD candidate who's the in-charge, not-in-charge person, and they used like Quaker signs for communicating, because isn't that quirky and cool, and it means that nobody's going to circumvent the power structure. And I was like, wow, it's amazing that nothing seemed to happen in the end. Or maybe that's harsh, but I don't know.
In our more politically oriented podcast, we never really got around to doing Occupy Wall Street. That was sort of on the list there. But you can tell Aaron Sorkin has a lot to say about Occupy Wall Street. Like, he was basically speaking as Neil there, giving his criticisms of the movement. But then he was also speaking through, the non-leader leader, because she had this rebuttal for him, right? She's like,
right,
"Hey, listen, we can't let the media cover this because the message will get distorted and that could be disastrous." You know, it's like, oh, someone's writing this from the future, huh? And instead of showing us these problems, they've just told us these problems. So he gets the chance to criticize the media and to criticize the movement at the same time, just in this little dialogue there. Just that's the kind of 2020 hindsight that I got real tired of last season.
Yeah, and I almost wonder, I don't know if this is the right moment for this meta conversation of, Aaron Sorkin gets a lot of flack for this show because it's political, and so I feel like there's certain, you know, pundits or figures on both sides that feel obligated to watch and see how this sort of recaps in a fictitious way recent history, and some people get upset at him because he's pandering to the left, and then other people get upset because he's doing this thing where, since Will McAvoy is technically a Republican, it's, you know, it's okay because he's giving enough credit to both sides, but he's sort of getting shot by both from both directions, and I don't know what to make of it, because I'm looking at it at this stage more from an entertainment perspective, and I do like, I think it is refreshing to try to get back to a positive, that on most issues he at least gives a token reference to both sides of the issue in a fair way, even though typically one side wins out over the other and gets a lot more screen time in describing why, you know, it should have gone this way when in real life you already know that it went another way or something like that.
I'll give you that. The Will McAvoy seems like a pretty reasonable, well-reasoned, I'll just say that word twice, I guess, kind of guy. He's pretty smart that if people thought like him, probably be a better country. I mean, you can't disagree with that.
Right.
So I have one more proto-criticism. That's how I'll put this.
Okay.
So the other aspect of the first season I really hated was the baked-in sexism. For example, you know, in the first season, men would make some dumb moves, but at least they held things together and acted more or less like grown-ups. Women, on the other hand, were prone to just flipping out and shrieking and crying at the smallest things, and they always needed men to come and calm them down and fix things. So I'd come back on YouTube. And we had another of Mackenzie's technology goose with the conference call. At least it wasn't as bad as the reply all that ruined everything last season, because they were both pretty minor and not huge plot points. Although two women were called just whatever sorts of names. There was like the intern who had asked Will that famous question, and then didn't that boss guy call Sloane Sabbath, played by Olivia Munn, Money Skirt or something like that? We don't get cutesy nicknames for men on this show like that.
I don't remember that. I remember the Nerd Exchange, but that was different because it was not in the same category. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if it just...
It happened so fast, that dialogue.
Yeah. But I'm glad you're pointing this out, because you can sort of overlook it if you're not cognizant of it. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but it's pretty subtle, but it is true that, like, the women end up handling things in the end very irrationally. Even, like, the men in their most irrational states feel like one-third of the where the dial goes for the women. So
right.
I don't know what that means. I guess it's sexism. It's certainly a contrast and probably not, yeah.
Yeah, and I know I'm hyper-vigilant on this after last season, so I'll try to give it some room to surprise me. I'm not going to call that a ding at this point. Just, I've got my eye on you, newsroom.
Watch it. Throw a man under the bus every once in a while. Come on. We make mistakes, too.
That's right. Anyway, so I tried to start out with a few good things, but a lot of criticisms also came out. Think we have to say anything more to balance the good side out appropriately here?
Oh, I think I just need to get more in the zone with this show. I think, personally, well, we'll see where it goes, but I feel like I'm overly critical just because it's the first show, and it's just way different TV than I'm used to, and I have to get back into the mode of appreciating it for what it is and just kind of going along for the hammy ride in some cases. Because overall, like, I do like the witty dialogue, and I do enjoy the character interaction a lot more than I do in most shows, because here it's all about just back and forth, these characters that are really smart and on a different plane communicating, and I'll give it credit for that. We need more shows that do things a little more on that level.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I tend to, on average, any average minute of the show, I tend to like pretty well. It's just that it has just a few things in every episode that are just jaw droppers and almost deal breakers, and that's this line it rides. If you could somehow take those things out, it'd be a different show, I guess. But if you could extricate those things, it'd be like a really great show. So I usually enjoy most of the episode when I watch it.
Yeah, well said. The sum of all the parts isn't as great as a lot of the parts in isolation. So yeah, I agree.
So we will keep recapping the newsroom, come back every week for our take on each episode.
Awesome.
Okay, Bob, I want to talk about The Bridge. This came last season, or last week is what I mean. This mm-hmm. is the pilot this time. And I think I mentioned a little bit in our weekend picks from last time, but You know, the premise is basically that a body was found on the U.S.-Mexico border, and detectives from both countries are working it. Starring Diane Kruger and Demian Bashir. And just hearing that premise, I don't think I was really prepared for exactly what's going on in this show, though, Bob. It's really more a show about how border towns interact, and also as a microcosm for U.S.-Mexico relations generally. The murder is just a device, a spark, to get the action going.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and this is not a spoiler-free, this is as much a recap as a review, so it is interesting how this unsolved murder starts as the initial premise, and that's kind of the way all the previews set it up, but then you learn that it's actually two bodies put together, and one's Latino and one's American, and this sophisticated hacker-like criminal, because he has to cut the power to lay the body there, and then he has to do some other things throughout the rest of the episode to continue his quest of making a statement. It becomes much more complicated, his intentions, and in a good way, because now I'm really interested to see where this goes, because it has a, you know, it brings up a lot of moral questions about, you know, the differences in demographics in two different countries that neighbor each other, and why do we care about one murder in one country and hundreds that are happening in another country we don't care about in the same way as a general society based on these two societies handling it differently. I'm probably jumping way too far ahead, but I'm just saying that it really starts out being like special victims unit, like a cable, you know, cop show or something, and then it like quickly evolves into something that's a little bit more than that. And then we've got Diane Kruger's character, who's kind of wacky in her own way. I'm all over the place, but I like where it's going. I'll just say that.
Yeah, I want to circle back around to it being something bigger, but I want to lay a little bit more of the groundwork first.
Sure.
So a big part of the success of a detective show like this is the chemistry between the detectives. And on The Bridge, they've got almost this like anti-chemistry, but it works.
Mm-hmm.
Diane Kruger is, as you mentioned, plays this, how did you put it? Got something wacky going on. So it's this weird thing where the promotional materials say that she has Asperger's syndrome, which is on the autism spectrum, but the show hasn't told us that yet, and critics say that even several episodes in, it hasn't mentioned that, so that's sort of weird, but I guess that's the story. And we are shown that she has something weird going on. So, like, she goes and she wants to tell the bereaved that the victim, the judge, is dead, and she's just not very good at it. She keeps, like, she keeps offering him water. It's like, no. She offers him again. It's like, no, I really don't want water. She's like, oh, crap, that didn't go the way the handout said it would.
Right. And, you know, I should research Asperger's syndrome more, because I always thought it had to do with, like, blurting out foul language at random moments.
That's any rats.
Jeez, I'm way off. We can edit that out. Or yeah, so Tourette's, Asperger's, okay, so I don't know my...
So we're seeing a good example of Asperger's. So it's like it's characterized by having a harder time empathizing and connecting with other people and with... goodness, I suppose we should
have something.
Instead of talking out of my ass on this, we could probably do everyone a service and say something real. Maybe for next time we'll prepare that. I'll stop now.
No, I think you did a fine job. And, you know, in my own defense, this is going to sound like a weak-ass defense, but I was expecting more language in this show, because it's like the following has been rated TVMA, mature, for language. And I was like, I don't think I heard a single swear word. I didn't know what happened, but this was a mature show about language.
There were some Spanish swear words, some bad ones.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. Maybe that's another point of the show on a subconscious level. I don't give Spanish swear words the same credibility as American swear words. I don't know.
But you're right. I didn't remember much language in English, which is usually why they have to give those warnings. So yeah, and Demian Bashir plays the Mexican detective, and it's his job to... His job requires him to be much, much savvier people-wise. We see him at one point go and ask the powerful dude for permission, basically, to investigate. Could you tell, Bob, was that like the mayor, or was it like some drug cartel lord? Who was that he was asking?
I thought he kept referring to him as like Capitan, or like, I thought he was like the police commissioner or something, but I don't know that it spelled it out for us exactly.
But I did get the sense that he was cavorting with undesirables at the very least.
Right, yes. And it was a very interesting contrast between how things are done on the American side of the border in terms of power distribution versus the Mexican side, where it's like one dude goes to a poker game at 3 a.m. in the morning and asks this guy with unwieldy power who's doing shady things if he can investigate something. And then on the American side, it's like, let's hurry up and see what we can get done before the feds take it over. They both have their problems, but very different ones.
Yeah, and we talk about having different problems. Perhaps my favorite scene was when they were in the car together, the two detectives, and she was asking him, because his... the body from his side was this lost girl who, you know, they got tons of them every year, and it was just sort of a formality, the investigation. Just giving him a hard time, like, well, how come you didn't investigate more? He's like, well, you know, it's a little bit different where I am. It's not that simple. It's like, you should have tried harder. Well, I tried. You should have tried harder. Jeez, lady. And it just sort of, it was very emblematic, I think, of just of how this show is going to go and the differences in the two towns, and also sort of the way I think perhaps a lot of Americans think, you know, Mexico runs. It's just that people aren't trying hard enough to fix things or something like that.
Yeah, and, you know, props to the show for conveying these things in a pretty straightforward manner without it being... without any sort of believability issues, or I still thought the dialogue and the character interaction was pretty well done, even though by comparison to the previous show we just recapped, The Newsroom, it's not like snappy and back and forth and, you know, witty, because that's not the point. But it felt very real, even though they were talking about pretty heavy subjects and they were hitting them head on in their conversations while driving in a car. But they did a really good job with that.
Yeah, and with character development, another scene that's popping into my head, when the Mexican detective comes to the police station in El Paso, he brings like this pastry, I forget what it's called, and he was just smooth the way he talks her into having one by just ignoring her saying no. She's like, oh, but it's really good. Okay, I'll have one.
I'll just leave these here if later on in the day you want to.
The ones with walnuts are really good.
Yeah.
So... the other thing I want to say is I agree with you a lot about how it shows so much of this stuff. It you know, the relationship these two detectives have, the relationship the two cities have. We get that there's this huge disparity and that it's a problem and a travesty really well through the story, the characters, the dialogue, all that. And then, you know, at the end when there's that bomb that's not a bomb, it's just a message. I was sort of rolling my eyes at that little recorded message because after it goes through all these lengths to show us the disparity here and what a problem it is, it feels like it has to hit us over the head with just saying it, with telling us after it had showed us. Like, there are this many murders, this many thousand murders in, is it Juarez, and six in El Paso. Why is there such a difference? Rah, 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 I'm going to be a terrorist until you figure this out.
It's funny you frame it that way because I totally get what you're saying, but when it happened, to me it felt, I'm giving it the benefit of the doubt because I'm still, the jury's still out on what this criminal or alleged, whoever this theoretical psychopath is that's making a political point in a very... crazy way. I actually kind of thought it was interesting that they did all of this nuanced approach to showing the disparity and the differences between the two sides and developing it very subtly, and then you getting it without feeling like you have to be hit over the head. And then they do this approach. Yeah, then you get hit over the head. But I almost thought it was like an ironic contrast, or like it's just showing this is the wrong way to do it after we just got through, I don't know, maybe this is a weird subconscious thing for me, but I thought they just did a really good job doing it the right way, and then they show how this criminal is doing it the wrong way. And this is me giving the show the benefit of the doubt, because now I'm really intrigued, more than being annoyed at the fact that I was hit over the head by them making that point as a show. I'm more interested in the motives of this criminal, because he seems like a pretty sophisticated... complicated bad guy that I want to get to know a little bit more, and so that's why I'm giving his tactic of progressing the show's agenda, you know, I'm giving that a little bit of a pass because I just want to see more.
Fair enough. I am very interested to see more. I just feel like he's like the social studies teacher turned terrorist, like the version of Walter White, except the social studies high school teacher instead
right.
of chemistry teacher or something like that.
Well, I hope it doesn't devolve into just something like that, but that I can see how that vibe is one direction it could certainly go.
Anyway, so that was a little bit annoying to me at the end, but overall I really liked the show and I'm excited for us to keep watching it and keep recapping it.
Yeah, it was a great pilot. I don't want to oversell it, but it's probably one of the better new shows that I'm interested in. I got hooked pretty quickly. Too early to say what that means, but great pilot.
Yeah, and we will keep on it. So that brings us to our last recap of the evening, Ray Donovan.
Ray Donovan.
I was relieved, Bob, to finally get some answers to the things that have been bothering me about Ray Donovan this week. Of course, I'm not sure the answers themselves helped a whole lot as far as my estimation of the show, I have to say. But
sure.
Let's go through some of these. For one thing, I think we figured out that Ray smiled at the end of the last episode because he learned his dad had killed the wrong priest and could use it against him, which he immediately starts trying to do, to put him back in prison.
Yes, yep.
And then we also learn, of course, that Mickey is an FBI snitch, and by the end it seems like they're after Ray and his whole operation under, what, RICO, maybe? Are they organized crime here? I don't feel like we've seen enough to justify an entire federal RICO investigation against these guys. But Ezra did say to Ray in an earlier episode, we fixed some things that shouldn't have been fixed, Ray.
Ezra's character is so, like, such a Debbie Downer. He's, like, paranoid in every scene, even at his own party where he's throwing a party for his deceased wife and dedicating a multi-million-dollar research facility to her. He, like, starts going off the handle because he sees Mickey in the crowd, and just every scene, he's like, we've got to look over our shoulder. We've done horrible things. I'm going to start speaking in Yiddish.
Yeah, that's right. But yeah, we haven't seen him do anything that's bad enough to have a whole RICO investigation
No, you're right.
On him yet, even though the bag and the bat, that certainly was not very nice, but that would just be a regular police issue, not federal investigation like this. So around the third episode, I'm glad they gave us a few answers like this, but they better not drag that one out, why they're wanted by the feds, too long, or otherwise I'll just be further annoyed.
You know, yeah, speaking of being annoyed, I think I figured out, this probably seems obvious, maybe we've already stated it, but the fact that Ray and Mickey are father and son, Mickey's the father, Ray's the son, just to, in case you don't know, at this point you should if you're watching the recap of the third episode, but that just doesn't, it continues to not work for me. Like, everything else could be as extreme as it is, but the fact that they're father and son and they're trying to beat the clock on putting each other in prison, like, even if, it would be so much better even if Mickey was like his father-in-law instead of his direct father. It's just too much, Logan. It's too much. It's like,
Yeah, well, I have to say that even though we are under the impression that Mickey's a bad dude, I was thinking the same thing. Won't that alienate him from the rest of his family if you snitch? Like, this isn't, like, so what Ray's doing is sort of bad, but, mm-hmm. but he isn't, like, going undercover and pretending everything's fine and then selling that information for money to the FBI to put his dad in jail the way Mickey's doing. I just can't imagine the rest of his family would be okay with this and not, you know, kick him out of the family. Basically, that's how families
right.
like this work, right?
Right, and the show's setting you up to be on Ray's side, like 3-1, because even though Ray like doesn't talk to his wife and does these shady things or whatever, he's still he's doing it with this premise of wanting to better the life of his family, even though he does it in a semi messed up way. Whereas his father is like doing everything in the way that you'd hate a character who is being nice to his grandkids on the surface only to screw them by trying to get their father in prison and walk away with money, and then they also make a point of showing Mickey like checking out porn in a or like, you know, light porn in a library or whatever. And it's just,
he's an ass guy.
Yeah.
yeah, and it, for what? For a little bit of money and to get out of jail in 15 years instead of 20? I mean, jail is jail, of course, but you know, and it's one thing if you get 5 years off your 5-year sentence, so you could go to jail for 5 years, but you go to zero. But right. if Vern had been there for 15, it's, I mean, what do I know? But it just seems like to get that 5 years off, that's not, I wouldn't think that'd be enough to justify going and trying to get your family.
Well, and the other thing that doesn't make sense in terms of motives of characters is if Mickey is really trying to get back at Ray, and we still don't know what is going on between them that's on this level of, you know, it can't be reconciled even though they're father and son. If he's trying to get back at Ray and get 5 years off of his sentence and get some money, and that's why he's doing all these things to pretend to be nice with the family or whatever, what's the deal with killing the priest? Because he knows that that is not something that's just going to go away. He's not that smart of a... He's not that dumb of a guy to know, to think that he can get away with a murder that's not really, it didn't show it as if like he meticulously planned it through or anything. That's a big risk for somebody who is trying to shrink a sentence down from 20 years to 15. Oh, and then on the side, because of the goodness of my heart for my other son, I'm going to murder someone. It's just like, it doesn't add up. Like, which character are you? I don't quite get him.
Yeah, maybe he was hoping no one would find out. Maybe he was hoping that his FBI guy could get him out of a local homicide rap. I don't know, but you're right. You are right.
Yeah,
he did learn a couple. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, but I'm still I'm getting into the show a little bit more. I'm still wanting to learn more about Ray because I feel like it hasn't given us much more than we knew. But
I got actually two more things I want to point out that we've learned. So
tell me.
Where is it? Oh, Ray gave his neighbors a card to call a lawyer. So that guy is a lawyer that Ray works with. That's at least some clue.
Right.
He's a lawyer's fixer, which we didn't know that much before. So that's something. I'm glad for that. Ezra doesn't seem to be a lawyer, though, and Ray's definitely not a lawyer, so I don't quite know this whole operation, but one piece of the puzzle there. And we learned one more thing. So we learned a little bit more about why he intervenes in these cases, even if it's against the wishes of his clients. Is it because he has some moral or ethical code? It's because he thinks he's everyone's dad. You know, his brothers, he plays the dad, and they resent him for always trying to pay for him or to sign on for a durable power of attorney on Bunchy's money. People he meets on his cases, like Chloe, he tries to be her dad and look out for her. Or the girl who had a stalker in the first episode, it's because he feels like her dad, and so he wants to protect her. And even Marvin Gaye Washington is like, I'm going to help you you buy this kid, but you better make sure he goes to school, no drugs. Not even a reefer, no drugs. It's because he thinks he's everyone's dad. That's his deal. It's not, I don't know, and I'm disappointed that that's his thing, really.
Oh, yeah? I'm glad you brought this up, because I disagree with you. I'm actually sympathetic toward this motivational theme, I guess. I think Ray actually, for all of his faults and the way he doesn't talk to his wife, he hasn't necessarily made super bad calls in terms of, I mean, he's probably gone around things or gone through with things the wrong way or not necessarily the best way. But when he is trying to get the power of attorney for his brother or tell the father no drugs if we get you this kid, or even the way he talks to his own son or daughter and tries to keep his crazy father out of their life, like, I see this good-hearted person coming through who actually has a good head on his shoulders on what constitutes taking care of people around him to make them to enable them to have a good life but still a somewhat protected life. But I know that, like, you know, as a theme in life, you and I guess it's fair to say me too, we're not huge fans of, like, for your own good ways of
right.
telling the world how to live, but I'm okay with how Ray's kind of going about it.
All right.
I want to see how it plays out. If hopefully he doesn't make any big mistakes and ruins my theory.
And at least it makes some sense now. At least I can start to try to get Ray figured out, even if I don't love that aspect of it. So that's big. The other thing I wanted to say is about Abby's wife, Ray's wife, Abby, played by Paula Malcolmson. I'm really tired of her. I love Paula Malcolmson as an actor, but they just got her this shrieking shrew here. You know, there's the scene when Ray came home, dropped off his laundry, packed for another 5 days, and she was just yelling at him the whole time. And, you know, the thing about Abby is she basically has what I call Paul Krugman syndrome. Even if I agree with her sometimes, I'm just turned off by the way she makes her point, and I regret agreeing with her. So,
right.
Sure, Ray seems like a crappy husband, but, you know, why is she freaking out now? He's probably been the same crappy husband for 15 years. It's nothing new. And we haven't seen Ray do anything that's like the straw that broke the camel's back or anything particularly bad right now. So I would have thought she would have come to peace with this to some extent or gotten tired of it. It's really weird that she's flying off the handle like this now.
Right. You're scared of the scenes where she has a reason to fly off the handle. I mean, she has a 15-year broken marriage reason in these scenes we're seeing, but they kind of come out of nowhere without enough development beforehand for her to be justified in her outrage, and it just feels very, like, the show needs to do a better job of setting her up for that level of outrage for Ray's behavior, or she needs to dial it back and, like, the acting or the... Well, it's not entirely her fault, but the director and actor relationship here needs to, like, play through that scene a little more realistically.
Opinion. She should have divorced him 15 years ago or get a little perspective on what's going on here.
Right.
All right. So I think we're going to certainly keep watching Ray Donovan, Bob, but we have to check in about whether we're going to keep recapping it. This is our third recap this time, which is a lot. And even more importantly, as a negative mark, it's hard to have more than one Sunday night at 10 o'clock time slot show.
Right. Yeah, we're recapping this on a Monday after a Sunday night when there's the newsroom and Ray Donovan at the same time. And, you know, I think the newsroom has a little more of a aura about it. Like, I feel like there's more going on and people are more engaged there. And Ray Donovan... This third episode, it didn't go down, but if anything, it might have gone up slightly for me.
I agree.
Like, I'm more interested now. I was more inclined to give it up after the second episode, but I feel like compared to everything else that's out there, this may not deserve like the weekly recap. I think we might just want to circle back after. I'm going to keep watching it because I'm into it now a little bit, but maybe just a season overview. And who knows? Maybe we're wrong, and this is the new, you know, it's the Sopranos all over again or something. But somehow I doubt it. But we'll see.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We'll give it a season overview at the end. And you're right. I don't know that I like the newsroom more, but the newsroom seems more recap worthy for some reason. If that makes sense, it gets me fired up a little bit more than Ray Donovan does.
Right.
So all right, this will be our last recap of Ray Donovan for the foreseeable future.
Unless we get, like, tons of comments and people are like, no, this was our favorite. By tons, I mean, like, three. No.
Yeah, we're open to persuasion. We're here to give you what you want, listeners.
Convince us, yeah.
All right. It's TV, it's movies, it's practically culture. And that is this week's episode, Bob. Find us at practicallyculture.com. Catch our new YouTube channel where you can see video clips of this episode. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Logan Bo, Bob's at Bob Caswell. Leave us a comment. Send us a tweet. Let us know how you like the new format. Get out there and watch some TV and movies, people. It's good for you. Thanks for rocking with us.
Have a good one.